Matthew chapter 12, verses 1 to 21 says, "At that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath. His disciples were hungry, and they began to pluck heads of grain to eat. But when the Pharisees saw it, they said to him, 'Look, your disciples are doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath.' He said to them, 'Have you not read what David did when he was hungry and those who were with him? How he entered the house of God and ate the bread of the presence, which is not lawful for him to eat, nor for those who are with him, but only for the priests. Or have you not read in the law how on the Sabbath the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are guiltless? I tell you, something greater than the temple is here, and if you had known what this means, 'I desire mercy, not sacrifice,' you would not have condemned the guiltless. For the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath." He went on from there and entered their synagogue. And a man was there with a withered hand. And they asked him, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath?" So that they might accuse him. He said to them, "Which one of you who has a sheep, if it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will not take hold of it and lift it out? Of how much more value is a man than a sheep? So it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath." Then he said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." And the man stretched it out, and it was restored, healthy like the other. But the Pharisees went out and conspired against him how to destroy him. Jesus, aware of this, withdrew from there, and many followed him, and he healed them all, and ordered them not to make him known. This was to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet Isaiah, "Behold, my servant whom I have chosen, my beloved with whom my soul is well pleased. I will put my spirit upon him, and he will proclaim justice to the Gentiles. He will not quarrel or cry aloud, nor will anyone hear his voice in the streets. A bruised reed he will not break, and a smoldering wick he will not quench, until he brings justice to victory. And in his name the Gentiles will hope."
Thanks, Ashley. Well, we are continuing our sermon series in the book of Matthew together this morning. And as we do, kind of want to back up just a little bit and remind us of why we're spending so many weeks working our way through Matthew. I believe we're right around 20-ish weeks or so into the sermon series at this point, and we are just this morning starting chapter 12 out of 28, so we've got a ways to go. So why did we as elders feel like this was a good way to spend the year or so that we're going to be here in the book of Matthew? I was actually just having a conversation with Caden at DC this week about how and why we pick certain books to go through together as a church. And it reminded me that usually when we start a new book, we spend a week on the front end kind of looking at that book as a whole. Usually we talk in that first sermon about why we're going through that particular book at that time. But with Matthew, we kind of just jumped right in to the genealogy in the first sermon, and we didn't really talk about this at all, I don't think, at the beginning. And so part of the reason why, going back to last year's elder retreat when we decided to preach through Matthew this year, there's always a few different reasons why we feel like the Lord is leading us to preach through a particular book. But one of the main reasons why we wanted to spend time in Matthew this year was pretty simple and straightforward, and it's to see Jesus, to spend time looking at Jesus and listening to Jesus. Like to see from the book of Matthew who Jesus is. Like, yes, to hear his teaching, to see his miracles, to be confronted with his death and resurrection and the mission that he gives us after his resurrection. To think about what all that means for us as his people. Like, we need all of that to respond rightly to who Jesus is. But the primary goal as we go through Matthew in a whole lot of ways is to see him, to spend time with him, to see from this book who he is and what he's really like, and to get to know him as he reveals himself to us in this book. And so this past couple of weeks in particular are exactly why it's so important for us to see Jesus and know Jesus. I know for many of us here in this room, increasingly over the past years, but as Daniel just prayed in some really specific ways in these past couple of weeks, it feels like the world is just getting more and more out of control. It feels like evil is running rampant and darkness is overwhelming. And so, like, whether it's shootings or stabbings or drone strikes or cancer or chronic disease or broken relationships or parenting struggles or whatever other effects and consequences of sin that it may be. Like in this room this morning, we come in here and we're hurting, we're suffering in different ways, and we're weary. And in all of that, what we need more than anything else is Jesus. Like we need to see Him as He really is, and know Him as He really is, because who He is makes all the difference in how we live here and now, and how we respond to the brokenness all around us and in us, and how we respond to the weariness that we feel because of it. And so that's exactly what our passage here this morning is going to do for us. You might be a little surprised to hear me say that if you were listening as Ashley just read this passage a minute ago, or if you've been reading through this passage this week in anticipation of this morning. Like at first glance, it sounds like this is a passage about the Sabbath and about whether we should keep the Sabbath or not and what's okay and what's not okay to do on the Sabbath. And so that's definitely the context here in this passage. And in that, there's definitely sermons to be preached about the Sabbath and what Jesus is teaching about the Sabbath here. But what we're going to see is that all through this passage, Matthew is telling us that the main point in these verses, like the main focus in these two Sabbath arguments that we're going to see here, is Jesus. Like who Jesus is. And what Jesus is like. Matthew's using these arguments about the Sabbath to bring together really everything that we've seen so far in this book and to spell out as clearly as possible, like, this is Jesus. This is who He is. And this is what He's like. And since that's Matthew's main point here in these verses, that's what we're going to focus on this morning as well. So you can see this then on your handout. What we're going to see here in the first part of Matthew 12 this morning is this. It's two defining characteristics of Jesus. And we're going to see how, as different as these two characteristics may seem at first, they're really two sides of the same coin. That Jesus is always both of these things. Like both of these characteristics are who He ultimately is and what He is ultimately like. And then we'll talk about how we should respond in light of these two defining characteristics of Jesus. Like if this is who Jesus is, then how should we respond to Him? And so my prayer for us then in all of this morning is that in seeing Jesus as He really is, our hearts would be comforted and encouraged and strengthened in Him and by Him in the ways that each of us need here this morning. And so let's look then together at these two defining characteristics of Jesus here in Matthew 12, verses 1 through 21. And the first defining characteristic of Jesus then is this. It's that Jesus has ultimate authority. Jesus has ultimate authority. Like that's Matthew's main point here in chapter 12, verses 1 through 8. And so let's walk through these verses together here, and we'll see how Matthew is making that point here. So look with me at verse 1. And we'll see here first the setting and the context for what's about to happen. And so verse 1 of chapter 12 says, at that time. And so even pause right there for a second. Right off the bat here, what Matthew's doing is connecting what's about to happen here in chapter 12 to what we just saw at the end of chapter 11. The time that this is at is when Jesus had just pronounced the woes on the unrepentant cities where He'd done most of His mighty works back in chapter 11, verse 20. And then, as we saw last week, He follows that up with some of the sweetest verses then in all the Bible. Matthew 11, 28 to 30. We've already referenced this once this morning. Come to Me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take My yoke upon you and learn from Me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For My yoke is easy and My burden is light. So in a lot of ways, the entire passage this morning that we're going to look at here this morning flows out of those verses. Like what we're about to see in this section of Scripture is the easy yoke and the light burden of Jesus contrasted with the impossible yoke and crushing burden of the Pharisees on one hand. But even more than that, what we're going to see is what does it mean that Jesus is gentle and lowly in heart? Like, what does that look like in real life? Does that mean that he's soft and squishy and kind of a pushover? Like, what does Jesus being gentle and lowly in heart look like? Like, that's the question that we should have in our minds as we read chapter 12, verses 1 through 21. And so at that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath. His disciples were hungry, and they began to pluck heads of grain and to eat. So notice here then in verse 1 how Jesus is singled out. Like our attention is meant to be on him. Like Matthew says that he is the one that goes through the grain fields. Like his disciples are with him and we're going to see what they do. But in a sense, the camera is focused on Jesus. And we're going to see that all through this section. He's the focus. Everything is zeroed in and zoomed in on him. And so we're not told exactly what grain fields Jesus is going through here or where exactly he is, but in this broader section of Matthew that this is all taking place in, this is Jesus' ministry in Galilee. So the specific location isn't super important other than that Jesus is going through some grain fields in Galilee, and we're told that this is happening on the Sabbath, which is going to be the focus throughout this entire section. Like the Sabbath comes up 8 different times here in these verses. And there's a whole lot we could get into when it comes to what the Sabbath is and the significance of the Sabbath in the Bible. But basically, the Sabbath goes all the way back to the beginning in Genesis 1 and 2. Like God created everything in 6 days, and then he rested on the 7th day. And Genesis 2 then says that God blessed the 7th day and made it holy or set it apart because he rested from his creating work on the 7th day. From there then, God made the 7th day a key part of the identity of his people. Like when he rescued Israel from slavery in Egypt and then gave them the 10 commandments, the 4th commandment is that his people are to rest on the 7th day. Like they're to follow God's pattern then of working 6 days and then resting on the 7th day, which is even what the word Sabbath means. Like the word Sabbath means to cease or to stop. So the focus is on the Sabbath being the day that you stop working and rest from your work like God did on the 7th day at creation. So again, there's a whole lot more we could get into there, but the point is that Jesus is going through the grain fields on the Sabbath day, which is the day of rest. And so as Jesus does this then, verse 1 says here that his disciples who are with him are hungry. And so as they're going through these grain fields, they begin to pick some of the grain there in the field as they're walking and they eat it, which to us sounds like, I mean, isn't that stealing? Like, this isn't their grain field. Like, should they be doing that? Well, God actually made provision for exactly this kind of situation in the Old Testament law. In Deuteronomy 23, verse 25, people are allowed to do exactly what the disciples are doing here. Like if you're going through your neighbor's field, you can pick the grain that's in their field with your hand and eat what you need in the moment. You just can't take your harvesting tools with you into your neighbor's field and like take a whole bunch of it home with you. But what they're doing is totally fine. The disciples are doing what the law allows here. They're hungry, so they're picking off some of the grain, probably then like rubbing it in their hands to get the papery husk off of it, and then eating the grain. Like you're not going to fill up doing that, but it's like a little snack on the way. And so like that's the setting, that's the context here. Jesus is going through these grain fields on the Sabbath, and his disciples are hungry, so they're picking some of the grain with their hands and they're eating it. And so look then, what happens, though, in verse 2? Verse 2, but when the Pharisees saw it, they said to him, look, your disciples are doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath. So we're not told where the Pharisees come from here, why they were there to see what the disciples were doing. They just kind of pop up out of the grain field here. They see the disciples picking and eating this grain, and they come to Jesus and confront him about this. Again, notice how the focus is not so much on the disciples as it is on Jesus. Like the Pharisees don't go to the disciples and correct them. They go to Jesus and confront him about what his disciples are doing. And so specifically what they're upset about then is that Jesus' disciples are doing what they believe is not lawful to do on the Sabbath, and he's letting them do it. Like, that's what they're upset about. That's what they're bothered by here. And so in one sense, what the Pharisees are bringing up here is rooted in some severe warnings that God had given his people about keeping the Sabbath. Like, listen to what God says in Exodus 31, starting in verse 12 here. Exodus 31, verse 12 says, "And the Lord said to Moses, 'You are to speak to the people of Israel and say, above all, you shall keep my Sabbaths. For this is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I, the Lord, sanctify you. You shall keep the Sabbath because it's holy for you. Everyone who profanes it shall be put to death. Whoever does any work on it, that soul shall be cut off from among his people. 6 days shall work be done, but the seventh day is a Sabbath of solemn rest, holy to the Lord. Whoever does any work on the Sabbath day shall be put to death.'" So, like, God is serious about not working on the Sabbath. Like, whoever works on the Sabbath is to be put to death and cut off from the people of God. So, like, that's a serious consequence. The thing is, that word "work" here in this command is pretty broad. Like, what exactly qualifies as work? How do you know if you've crossed that line? That seems pretty important to know if the consequences are that severe, right? So there's a few places where God gives some specific examples in the law, but there's not really a specific definition or checklist spelled out of this is what work is, and you shall not cross this line. And so what had happened over time then is that the Pharisees and other religious leaders, other rabbis and teachers, in an attempt to make sure that no one got even close, even remotely close, to breaking that law and facing the death penalty for breaking the Sabbath, they put together then their own list of rules to define what work could not be done on the Sabbath day. And so there's different versions of this out there, but kind of generally agreed upon, there's 39 categories of work that they came up with that were forbidden on the Sabbath. And so if you go through that list, you could argue that what the disciples were doing here involved at least three of their categories of work that should not be done on the Sabbath. Like, picking grain from the stalk could be categorized as reaping and threshing, and rubbing the kernels in their hands to remove that papery husk could be seen as winnowing. And so, again, none of that's spelled out in the Bible, but according to the Pharisees' rules, all of those are no-nos on the Sabbath. Like, you shouldn't do any of those things. That's crossing that line, and you're in the danger zone. But again, they don't go to the disciples and tell them to stop doing these things. Their bigger concern here is that Jesus is letting this happen. They're coming to him and accusing him of allowing his disciples to do what is not lawful on the Sabbath. And it's really important to see that here to understand Jesus' response to the Pharisees then in the rest of this section. Because what we're going to see then in verses 3 through 8 are three responses then that Jesus gives to the Pharisees' accusation there in verse 2. They're accusing him of letting his disciples break the Sabbath, and he's going to give them three responses in verses 3 through 8. What we're going to see is that his responses focus less on correcting their understanding of what's lawful to do on the Sabbath than on correcting their understanding of who he is. And so look then at Jesus' first response here in verses 3 and 4. Here's what Jesus says first. He said to them, "Have you not read what David did when he was hungry, and those who were with him, how he entered the house of God and ate the bread of the presence, which was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those who were with him, but only for the priests?" So Jesus' first response to the Pharisees is to point back to 1 Samuel chapter 21, when David's on the run from Saul. And Jesus says that David and his followers were hungry, just like the disciples were here in verse 1. And Jesus says that David, because of that then, entered the house of God and ate the bread of the presence, which was a stack of loaves of bread that represented the people of God that were to be set out in the tabernacle every day. The thing is, that bread was only allowed to be eaten by the priests. And so in one sense, David and his followers were not priests. So they should not have been allowed to eat that bread. What they did was not lawful in that sense. But Jesus is saying that they did eat that bread. And the way that he tells the story here, the implication that he's making is that it was okay for them to do that. And so the question is, why? Why is Jesus okay with what David and his men did? Was it just because they were hungry? So, like, as long as you're hungry, you can break the law? That would be the lesson if that's the point. Or is Jesus' point that since David broke the law once in the past and it was okay then, it's okay for the disciples to break it again now? Like, I don't think that's the answer. I don't think that's Jesus' point. Like, in the context of everything that we've seen so far in Matthew, Matthew has been working from chapter 1, verse 1. We've talked about this all along the way to prove that Jesus is the long-awaited Messiah King from the line of David. And so he's doing something really specific in pointing back to David here. David had a unique role as the anointed king of God's people. And Jesus' point here then is that David was allowed to eat the bread of the presence and to share it with his followers because of who he was. He was the anointed king. Like, he could do what no one else would have been allowed to do. Like, that's the point. And the point then is that Jesus is the new David, the greater David, who can do what no one else is allowed to do. And so Jesus' first response to the Pharisees' accusation then is, if David could eat the bread of the presence and share it with his followers because of who he was, how much more can Jesus, the new David, share this bread with his followers because of who he is? So that's his first response to them. Next then, look at Jesus' next response in verses 5 and 6. He says, or have you not read in the law how on the Sabbath the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are guiltless? I tell you, something greater than the temple is here. So next, his next response then is Jesus points the Pharisees again to the Old Testament, this time to the priests in the temple. And he points out how the priests in the temple work on the Sabbath. Like, the law itself actually gives them work to do related to offering sacrifices and keeping up the temple, and they have to do those things even on the Sabbath. So in one sense, they're working on the Sabbath. Like, they're profaning the Sabbath by breaking that law of working on the Sabbath. But Jesus says that they're guiltless. So again, the question is, what makes it okay for them to work on the Sabbath? Is it just because there are other laws telling them to do those things and those laws supersede these laws? Like, in one sense, that would make sense, but that's not what Jesus says here. Instead, Jesus' answer is, it's because of what the temple is. Like, the temple is the place where God's presence is specifically located among his people. And so when the priests are serving in the temple, they're serving in the presence of God himself. Like, they're serving God in a unique way that if they were working anywhere else on that day, they wouldn't be serving him in the same unique way that they are because of where they are. Like, it's what the temple is that made it okay for the priests to work there on the Sabbath. So don't miss Jesus' point in verse 6 then. He says that something greater than the temple is here. And so there's a whole lot we could get into here, but guess what that something is? It's Jesus. He is where the presence of God ultimately dwells with his people. And so Jesus' point is that if it's okay for the priests to work on the Sabbath in the temple because of what the temple is, how much more is it okay for Jesus' followers to work on the Sabbath, if that's what you want to call work, but if it is, then they can do that because of who he is. The greater temple right there with them. And so, like, those are two huge claims. Like, Jesus is the new David, and he's the greater temple. But those pale in comparison to the third response here he has in verses 7 and 8. Look there with me next. Verse 7, if you had known what this means, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the guiltless. For the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. So Jesus takes the Pharisees to one more Old Testament passage here, Hosea 6:6. Which he's already quoted to them back in chapter 9 when they were mad at him for eating with tax collectors and sinners. And so at one level, he's telling them, you still haven't learned the point of what God was saying there in Hosea about desiring mercy more than sacrifice. And if they did understand that, they wouldn't be accusing the disciples here. But again, don't miss then what he's saying in verse 8. Verse 8 says, for, like, here's the reason verse 7 matters, and even why verses 3 to 6 matter as well. For, because the Son of Man, which we've talked about already, is the title that Jesus uses most often for himself, which is, and it's a reference back to Daniel chapter 7, where one like a Son of Man comes to the Ancient of Days, to God himself, and is given authority and dominion over all creation. Like, that's Jesus. He's the Son of Man. He's the one who's going to be given all authority over all creation. And Jesus says that he, the Son of Man, is Lord of the Sabbath, which the word Lord there means master. So in other words, like, he's the master of the Sabbath. In that sense, he's saying that because he has authority over all things as the Son of Man, he also has authority over the Sabbath, which means that he's the one who gets to determine and say what it's okay to do on the Sabbath and what it's not okay to do on the Sabbath. But it's even bigger than that. Like, the Lord of the Sabbath is ultimately God, right? Like, all throughout the Old Testament, when God talks about the Sabbath, he calls it my Sabbath, or he talks about a Sabbath to the Lord. And so in that sense, only God can claim to be the Lord of the Sabbath. So Jesus here claiming to be the Lord of the Sabbath is a claim to be God. And so verse 8 here is saying that Jesus has double authority over the Sabbath, in a sense, as the Son of Man and as Lord of the Sabbath. And do you see how all this comes together then? The Pharisees are questioning who Jesus thinks he is to allow his disciples to do what's not lawful on the Sabbath. And Jesus' answer is, here's who I am. I'm the greater David. I'm the greater temple. I'm the Son of Man. And I'm the Lord of the Sabbath. And the point in all that is that Jesus has ultimate authority. Like, that's who he is. That's what he's like. Which has implications far beyond just this specific question related to the Sabbath. Like, he's the ultimate human authority, the Son of Man, the Messiah King from the line of David, and he's the ultimate authority, like God himself, the Lord of the Sabbath. And he brings both of those together then as the ultimate temple, the place where God dwells with his people. Which in one sense is good news, right? Like, if he's the ultimate authority, we can trust that he's in control of all things, even the things that are going on around us and in our own lives that we don't understand and that leave us hurting and grieving and weary. Like, those things aren't out of his control. They don't catch him off guard. There's not some authority higher than him doing things that Jesus has no control over. So going back then to Matthew 11, verse 29, Jesus being gentle and lowly in heart does not mean that he's soft or that he's not in control. No, like, he's in control of all things. He has the authority to tell us what to do and what not to do, and everyone will ultimately give an account to him for whether we do what he tells us to or not. Like, if that wasn't true, we would have reason to be shaken when things feel out of control, because we wouldn't know for sure who actually is in control. But if Jesus is the ultimate authority, we can know that nothing that's happening is outside of his control. But here's the thing. The reality of Jesus being the ultimate authority by itself isn't necessarily good news, right? Like, it's only good news if he cares about us and if he's working for our good. And that's the other side of the coin. That's the truth that bookends this entire section going back to the end of chapter 11 last week. And I tried to come up with other words for this point on your handout, but nothing captures it as well as the words of chapter 11, verse 29. And so the other defining characteristic of Jesus is that Jesus is gentle and lowly in heart. He's gentle and lowly in heart. Again, we saw those words specifically last week, but we see what that looks like illustrated then in the rest of our passage here this morning. And so look there with me next, starting in verse 9. Verse 9 says, he went on from there and entered their synagogue. And so what's happening here, I mean, we're on the same day, basically, is the reality. And these things happen kind of back to back. Jesus moves on from the grain fields and enters their synagogue, where the people from that area would be gathering because it was the Sabbath. But the way that that's worded there, their synagogue, is also worded in a way that almost seems to emphasize the opposition that Jesus is facing as he walks in to the room there in their synagogue, which is exactly what we see in verse 10. Verse 10 says, and a man was there with a withered hand. And they asked him, the Pharisees, they asked him, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath, so that they might accuse him? So when Jesus comes into the synagogue, then there's a man there who has a withered hand, which we're not told exactly what happened, what caused this, but basically, whatever this is, his hand is unusable. Probably muscles and things shriveled up to where he can't open his hand or use his hand at all. And the reality is it probably been that way for quite some time. And so the Pharisees see an opportunity here. And we're told that their intentions are not good. Like, they're asking this question not because they genuinely want to know. This is a trap. They're trying to set Jesus up. They ask him this innocent-sounding question about whether it's lawful to heal on the Sabbath, but they're trying to get Jesus to do something that they believe is unlawful so that they can accuse him of breaking the law, which, again, has serious consequences. So the thing is, just like with the last section, with the issue around picking the grain, there's no scripture passage that says you can't heal someone on the Sabbath, but this is one of the restrictions that they would have had in their own minds, like one of the ways that they had defined working on the Sabbath. And so there's some debate over whether healing at all on the Sabbath was allowed or not, but if anything, there definitely would have been a line in their mind about healing only when it was a life or death situation. Like, if you have to do it on the Sabbath, you only do it if it's a life or death situation, which this is clearly not, right? Like, it's inconvenient, but this could wait until tomorrow. It's already probably been a while for this man, and so it could wait. The question is Jesus going to let it? Look how Jesus responds to their question. Notice here in verse 11 and 12 what Jesus says, and then what Jesus does in verse 13. So verse 11 and 12, what Jesus says, he says this, he said to them, "Which one of you who has a sheep, if it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will not take hold of it and lift it out? Of how much more value is a man than a sheep? So it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath." So this time, Jesus doesn't point them to a passage of scripture. He appeals to common sense, like what everyone would agree to be true. And the point is, if you have a sheep, which in their day wasn't so much like a pet, it was a form of provision, a form of income, so valuable to them in that sense, but at the same time, it was a living thing that they did care about. And so you have a sheep that falls into a pit, which would have been like a trap for a wild animal. And so your sheep falls into this trap, and it's stuck. It can't get out by itself, but it's the Sabbath. The reality is, like, that pit is not a good place for your sheep to be. It's going to have a tough time in that pit. It's going to suffer in that pit, but in all likelihood, it could survive until tomorrow. So what do you do? Like, it's the Sabbath. You're not supposed to do any work. It's going to take a little bit of work, to at least a little bit of effort, to get that sheep out of the pit. So do you just leave it until the next day to make sure that you don't break that Sabbath rule and potentially risk something happening to the sheep and let the sheep suffer till the next day? But man, you make sure you don't break the law, right? Jesus' point is, that's not what anybody would do. Like, you care about the sheep. You wouldn't let it suffer in that pit till the next day. Like, anybody would get the sheep out of the pit. Like, that's what you would do. And his point is, that would be okay. And Jesus says, of how much more value than a sheep is a human being? Like, if anybody would do that for a sheep, how much more should you do what you can to help a human being who's hurting or suffering, even if it's the Sabbath? And then he just spells it out for him right there at the end of verse 12. It is lawful to do good on the Sabbath, which goes back to the principle in verse 7. God desires mercy, not sacrifice. The point in both of those principles is that adherence to religious ritual at the expense of doing good or extending mercy missed the whole point. That's what Jesus says here in 11 and 12. And then look at what he does, verse 13. Then he said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." And the man stretched it out, and it was restored, healthy like the other. So Jesus doesn't just say, this is what you should do. He does it. And in this case, he does what no one else there could have done. He tells the man to stretch out his hand, which, whatever was going on with his hand, is exactly what he could not do. But when Jesus tells him to do it, he does. And when he does, it's miraculously restored so that it works again and functions just like his other hand. And we know enough about the Pharisees to know this, but in one sense, their reaction is shocking. Like, they're not happy about what Jesus just did for this man. And look at verse 14, how they respond then. The Pharisees then went out and conspired against him how to destroy him. And so here's the thing. If this passage stopped right here, it would seem like the main point is the Sabbath and whether or not we should keep the Sabbath and what we should or shouldn't do on the Sabbath. But Matthew doesn't stop here. Sometimes the little breaks in our Bible can make it hard to see that, but if you follow along with the text, Matthew keeps going. And what Matthew is going to say in these next few verses, in a sense, is the key to understanding this entire section. So first, in verses 15 and 16, Matthew tells us what Jesus does when the Pharisees respond to him this way. So look there first. Verse 15, Jesus, aware of this, meaning aware that the Pharisees are conspiring to destroy him, withdrew from there. And many followed him, and he healed them all and ordered them not to make him known. So, yeah, Jesus knows the Pharisees are conspiring to destroy him. So how does he respond? We saw in verses 1 to 8 that he has ultimate authority, right? So does he defend himself? Does he go after them? Like take them out before they can take him out? No, he withdraws from there. Why? Because he's afraid of them? Like of what they might do to him? Like clearly not, right? He has ultimate authority. They can't do anything to him that he doesn't allow them to do. So why does he withdraw? And not only that, like why would Jesus heal all these people then as he continues to go and then tell them not to tell people who he is, not to make him known? Like isn't the whole point, like we've seen all the way through Matthew so far, that he's proclaiming the kingdom and he's previewing the kingdom? Like why would he not want all these people that he's going around healing to tell everybody about him and to tell them about his kingdom? Well, Matthew gives us the answer to those questions in the last few verses of our passage here this morning. He says that this quote, then, that he's going to give us from Isaiah 42 explains everything. Like the reason Jesus heals the man with the withered hand on the Sabbath, the reason he withdraws from the Pharisees' opposition, and the reason he tells people that he healed to not make him known are because of who he is. Look at verse 17. Let's see this here. Verse 17, Matthew says this. He says, "This was to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet Isaiah." And then he quotes from Isaiah 42, verses 1 to 4. And this is God speaking here in Isaiah. Matthew's point is that this is talking about Jesus. Like, this is who Jesus is. Verse 18, he says, "Behold, my servant whom I have chosen, my beloved with whom my soul is well pleased." And so, yeah, this is such a good passage. I wish we had time to dig into this even more. But not only is Jesus the Son of Man and Lord of the Sabbath, who has ultimate authority, he's also God's chosen, beloved servant. So Son of Man, Lord of the Sabbath, emphasize Jesus' authority. Chosen, beloved servant emphasizes his humility. And here's what Jesus' job then is as God's servant. God says next, "I will put my spirit upon him, and he will proclaim justice to the Gentiles." Again, a lot here we don't have time to get into this morning, but the point is that God is going to put his spirit on this one, on his chosen, beloved servant to do this job. And it's to proclaim justice to the Gentiles. And so what is that talking about? Well, the Gentiles here is specifically the word for nations. So in one sense, that's all the other nations besides Israel, which is why it's translated Gentiles here. But the focus is really on just the universal scope of what the servant is proclaiming, that he's proclaiming justice to all nations. Which Matthew's point is that this is exactly what Jesus is already doing. In proclaiming the kingdom and previewing the kingdom, that's what Jesus is doing. He's proclaiming justice to the nations. It's through people repenting and becoming part of Jesus' kingdom that God is reconciling the nations to himself and making things right. And it's through Jesus' kingdom that he will ultimately make everything right. Like that's the justice that he's proclaiming. And this next part is the key. Like, here's how the servant is going to do this. This is the job that the servant has. Here's how he's going to do it. Here's what he's going to be like as he does this work. Look at verse 19. "He will not quarrel or cry aloud," which those two words have a sense of not making a loud noise that startles people. Or the other one is, the other word there, crying aloud, is raising your voice to argue with people or dominate people or shout them down. So he's not going to be loud in a startling way or in an aggressive and controlling way. Next it says, nor will anyone hear his voice in the streets, which this has the idea of not calling attention to himself, like not advertising himself. And so all this, those two lines go together then to paint this picture of a quiet, unaggressive, unthreatening ministry. Like, that's why Jesus withdrew instead of fighting with the Pharisees or stirring up more controversy with them here in this section. Like, that's why he told the people that he healed not to make him known, because this is who he is and this is what he's like. But that's not all. Verse 20, a bruised reed he will not break, and a smoldering wick he will not quench. Like, a bruised reed here is a plant that the stalk's been damaged or bent. Like, it can't hold itself up anymore. And a smoldering wick is like a candle burnt down to just the very last little bit, and it's almost to go out. It's got almost nothing left. But the point here isn't plants or candles. It's people, right? Like, so the question is, have you ever felt like either one of those? Like, do you feel like either one of those this morning? Suffering, hurting to the point that you can't hold yourself up anymore. Worn out, weary to the point that you've got nothing left. Oh, see here how gentle Jesus is with bruised reeds and smoldering wicks. Like, as fragile as a bruised reed is, Jesus is so gentle, he won't break it. As easily as a smoldering wick could be quenched, Jesus is so gentle, he won't put it out. Like, that's who Jesus is. That's what Jesus is like with the broken and the weary. Like, this is what caused him to tell the man in the synagogue to stretch out his hand, even though it was the Sabbath, because he was a bruised reed and a smoldering wick, and Jesus cared about him. Like, there's no better way to summarize it than how Jesus described himself back in chapter 11. He's gentle and lowly in heart. Like, this is what that looks like. That's the whole point of this entire section. Jesus does what he does in verses 9 to 16 because this is who he is in verse 17 to 21. He does what he does because this is what he's like. Oh, but there's a purpose and a goal to his quiet, gentle ministry. Oh, this is such good news. Look at the next line there in verse 20. It says, until he brings justice to victory. And so in one sense, this is kind of the opposite side of what we talked about with the authority piece. It seems like good news that this is what Jesus is like, that he's gentle and lowly in heart. But if in the end, he's so gentle and lowly that he loses, like if the Pharisees conspire against him to destroy him, and they do, like, I guess it's nice to know that he cares for the broken and the weary, but where's the hope in that all by itself? So this is where the two sides of the coin come together again, because he's not only gentle and lowly in heart, he also has ultimate authority, and he's going to accomplish his plan. The justice that he proclaims, he will bring to victory. He will establish his kingdom. He will undo all of the effects of the fall. He will make everything right, and everyone who repents and trusts in him can share in his victory. Oh, but don't miss this. He's going to accomplish that victory through his gentle and lowly ministry. He's going to continue his quiet, gentle work all the way to the cross. And he's going to remain quiet even when it looks like he's going to be destroyed. But because he's in complete control, it's all part of the plan. He will receive ultimate authority as the Son of Man by being who he is as the chosen, beloved servant. Like, his victory will come through his gentle and lowly heart. And the result of this then is verse 21. And in his name, the Gentiles will hope. Like, as a result of the victory that he's going to win, all the nations then will hope in Jesus, the gentle and lowly servant who has ultimate authority. One commentator explains what hope means here this way. It says, they will stake their future on what he reveals to them, having been won to his allegiance. Like, isn't that good? They will stake their future on what he reveals to them, having been won to his allegiance. Like, they will stake, the nations will stake their future on Jesus and on his kingdom because they've been won to his allegiance. And the point here is that what wins them to his allegiance is who he is and what he's like. Like, there's no one else like Jesus. So what do we do with all this? How should we respond to Jesus in light of who he is and what he's like? At the end, I was rereading some of this week. At the end of the book, Gentle and Lowly, which if you've never read that book, you should read it. If you have read it, you should read it again. Dane Ortlund, the author of Gentle and Lowly, says this at the end of the book. To ask, now how do I apply this to my life, would be a trivialization of the point of this study. If an Eskimo wins a vacation to a sunny place, he doesn't arrive in his hotel room, step out on the balcony, and wonder how to apply this to his life. He just enjoys it. He just basks. Which, that's funny. That's good. But it's also true, right? Like, in a lot of ways, that's the goal this morning. See who Jesus is and enjoy him. Like, bask in who he is. And I'm hesitant in one sense to minimize that by giving more specific application in some ways. But at the same time, I think Matthew and Jesus do call for a response here. If we just see who Jesus is and don't do anything differently in light of who he is, we don't really get it. And so really quickly, just to wrap all this up, I want to touch on four responses to Jesus that this passage at least hints at, if not specifically calls for. And you can see these on your handout here, how we should respond to Jesus. The first way we should respond to who Jesus is the ultimate authority, who's gentle and lowly in heart, is to submit to him. Submit to him. Like, in a sense, this is the first and most important response. Like, in our passage this morning, the Pharisees are a negative example of this. The point is, don't respond to Jesus like they did. Like, if Jesus has ultimate authority, our first response must be to bow the knee to him. To submit to him as the one who has authority over us, the one who gets to tell us what to do and to whom we will have to give an account for whether we did that or not. And so, like, if you're trying to set your kingdom up against his, beware. You're not going to win that battle. And you don't want to be his enemy when he comes to fully and finally establish his kingdom. Because he's gentle and lowly in heart, he's giving you time to see him for who he is and to submit to him as your king. And if you haven't responded to him that way, I would plead with you to do that today. Like, you can do that right now where you're sitting. Jesus calls you to repent, to turn from your sin, to turn from your rebellion against him as king, and to turn to him, to submit to him as your king. And so if that's you, I would plead with you, do that this morning. You can do that before you leave. You can do that right where you're sitting. Come talk to me. Come talk to one of the other elders. Talk to somebody around you before you leave if you need more guidance and more help in that. But please, hear what we're saying this morning. See who Jesus is and respond to him in this way. Submit to him as your king. Even for those of us who have submitted to him as our king in the sense that we just talked about, there's still a call for us to continue to submit to him here, like to continue to live under his authority. Like, it's so easy to drift back into living like we're the king of our own little kingdoms, but that's not true. And so be reminded of who Jesus is and let that put you and me in our place. The second way that we should respond is this, is to come to him. To come to him. And so in a sense, this goes back to last week's passage specifically, where Jesus calls us to do that, to come to him. But we see it as well in this week's passage, in the man with the withered hand. Like, this is what Jesus calls us to do in light of his gentle and lowly heart. Like, whether you're laboring and heavy laden, trying to earn your own righteousness by keeping all the rules that you know deep down you'll never be able to actually keep, or whether you're suffering from the effects of sin in you or sin around you in some of the ways we've talked about this morning, Jesus is gentle and lowly in heart. And he says, come to me. Like, he cares about you. And he has the power and he has the authority to help you. He may not take away whatever it is that you're suffering with right away, but he will give you rest for your soul here and now, and one day he will make everything right. So see Jesus for who he is and come to him. Like, if you're feeling like a bruised reed or a smoldering wick this morning, come to him. He cares about you. He'll deal gently with you, and he has the power and authority to do for you what he knows that you need. The third way we should respond to Jesus is this, is to follow him. follow him. And so the point here is to not just see Jesus for who he is and bow the knee once or come to him when you need something and then get on with your life and live however you want to live. Like if Jesus is who we see here in this passage, then we should respond like the disciples and we should respond like the people in verse 15 and follow him. Like stay with him, continue to learn from him. And the goal in that is to be shaped by him so that what he is like is what we become more and more like, so that we take on his character. Like the goal of the disciple is to be like his teacher. So the goal is to see Jesus, to spend time with Jesus. And the way that we do that is by seeing him in Scripture and what he shows us about himself in the Word. And so our desire in that is that as his people, as we spend time with him in the Word, we would reflect him and would reflect his character more and more in how we live. So the question is, if one of the defining characteristics of Jesus is that he's gentle and lowly in heart, like if he's characterized by quietness, compassion, kindness, and humility, like we've seen throughout the passage that we've looked at this morning, like are we reflecting those same characteristics in our lives as we follow him? Like that should be our desire, to follow him in that way, to see him for who he is, and to be more and more like him then in our lives. And then finally, and this is the last thing in the passage as well, hope in him. Hope in him. That's what we saw at the very end of our passage this morning. Stake your future on him and on his kingdom because you've been won to his allegiance. Like so many other things around us are calling for our allegiance and our hope, but they will all let us down, but not Jesus. So see Jesus for who he is and bank everything on him. Like if you're hoping in him that way, no matter what you face, no matter what you walk through in this life, nothing can ultimately shake you because your hope isn't in any of those things. It's in Jesus and in his kingdom. And because of who Jesus is, nothing can touch that hope. Oh, there's no one else like Jesus. He is the Son of Man and the Lord of the Sabbath who has ultimate authority. And he's the chosen, beloved servant of God who's gentle and lowly in heart and who wins his ultimate victory through his gentle and lowly work. So see him. See Jesus here in this passage. And then let that draw your heart to submit to him, to come to him, to follow him, and to hope in him. Let's pray. Father, thank you for who you are. Thank you for who Jesus is, sharing in everything that belongs to you, the divine nature that belongs to you, and how he reveals to us who he is and who you are, what you are like through his life, through the way that he navigates these situations, these arguments with the Pharisees that we looked at here this morning, how it reveals to us not just rules to follow, but a person to follow, a person who has ultimate authority and who's gentle and lowly in heart, and how those two characteristics together, inseparable from each other in so many ways, are our ultimate hope. The fact that Jesus is in control of all things, that nothing is outside of his control, no matter what we're walking through, no matter what we're feeling the weight of as we step into this room this morning, Jesus is in control of it, and we can rest in that. And we can rest in it because he's good, because he's kind, because he's gentle and lowly, because he won't break a bruised reed, because he won't quench a smoldering wick, because he's quiet, because he's unaggressive. All these things that we saw about him this morning, all of that works together to paint a picture that's so much more beautiful and compelling than anything that we could have ever imagined that anybody could be like. And so God, give us eyes to see the beauty of Jesus in this passage and draw our hearts to respond to him in the ways that we talked about this morning. Father, I pray that if there's anybody here that has not yet bowed the knee to him as king, that they would see how incredible of a king he is, they would see his ultimate authority, and they would see his kindness and his gentleness toward them and giving them the opportunity to repent, and that they would respond and bow the knee to him even this morning, Father. I pray that you would soften hard hearts, open blind eyes to see the beauty of Jesus, and draw people to yourself even this morning as they hear these words. Father, I pray then that as those who have submitted to him as king, that we would continue to submit to him as king, that we would see ways that in our own hearts that we're tempted to live for our own kingdoms, and that you would put that to death, and that we would submit and live for his kingdom. Father, I pray that we would see and hear the call to come to him, that in our weariness, in our tiredness, as we carry the load and the burden that we feel, that we would see that Jesus tells us, come to him and get rest for our souls, and come to him to meet our needs, and to believe that he would do that because he cares for us. Father, I pray that we'd follow him, that we would be more and more shaped by his character. And Father, I pray that our hope would ultimately be in Jesus, that you would protect us from our hope being drawn to anything else. Everything else will ultimately fail and will ultimately leave us empty. But Jesus alone is a rock solid hope for our souls. And I pray that we would see that and believe that and walk out of here, just won to his allegiance, and our future staked on his kingdom and on who he ultimately is. Father, do all that in us this morning, we pray. In Jesus' name, amen.